are listening to Stories That Matter, a Hawkwood podcast. In July 2019, Hawkwood held Seed Festival, an environmental festival focused on planting big ideas. One of the speakers at this year's Seed was Bibi van der Zee, a Guardian editor who writes about farming and food production.
Hi, my name is Bibi van der Zee. I am a journalist and editor at The Guardian. I run a series about animal farming around the world, and I'm here to give a speech at 12 o'clock about agriculture and climate change.
Can you tell me a little bit about your background and what kind of started your interest in agriculture and climate change?
So I became a journalist in 1995, and it was a really odd point in the world, this boom in consumption. I was writing about interiors and fashion and style, and it was just really weird to be covering, designer toilet roll holders and designer lemon squeezers, and it just seemed as if everyone assumed you could make things eternally. And I started to become more and more interested in sustainability and where were all these things coming from and where were they all going to. So I started to look into environmental issues, and it's such a fascinating area. And for a while I was the kind of odd bod at The Guardian. There were a tiny little handful of us who were worrying about this stuff, and then interest grew, and it became a mainstream subject, and yeah, I've been following it ever since.
So you didn't have like a background in farming when you were growing up or anything then?
No, not at all. I mean, in fact, completely the opposite. That's one of the reasons I was so interested. I grew up in London. I mean, I was born in London, grew up. We didn't have a garden, and I loved outside space. We used to, me and my sister would cycle to the Hampstead Heath, which is near where we grew up. So that was our idea, of heaven, being out in the trees. So I loved being outside, and I was always fascinated by food, but I didn't really know anything about it. And as a journalist, it's your job to, one of the reasons you become a journalist is because it's so interesting finding out about things you don't really know about. So, and food was kind of that for me, and farming.
So we're talking before your talk, but can you give a little kind of summary of what you might say?
Well, one of the things, I took this job looking specifically at farming a year and a half ago, and one of the questions I set myself then was the role of farming in climate change. And among many other things that we've covered since then, that's one of the things I've consistently just been looking for, trying to understand better. And it's obviously been a really interesting period for that question. I think everyone's coming to understand now that farming and agriculture and our consumption of meat and our consumption in general, the role those things play in climate change is much more significant than we'd previously realised. And so I'm going to talk a little bit about why we didn't understand that and what we have to do now that we do understand it.
What have you kind of noticed that's changed over the course of your covering these issues? Is it that sustainability has become more and more related to farming? Or, yeah, what's some of the bigger issues have come up?
I mean, I have been covering this a long time, so it is really, and it's really extraordinary to watch. I mean, I think we really forget to look back and see how far we've come. In 2009, when I went to Copenhagen, the idea then that we would be sort of, where we are now with an international agreement, it seemed absolutely impossible. And I think awareness and understanding of the issues is greater than it ever has been, thanks in large part to amazing organisations like Extinction Rebellion, who, we all need to give thanks for. And so I try to be optimistic about it, but it's hard not to feel a bit disappointed that despite so many years of coverage and despite so many years of really some really extraordinary people trying to, make the scientific case, trying to raise awareness, the action is still not where it needs to be. And it's hard not to start to feel a bit depressed about that sometimes.
Why do you think that growing awareness hasn't led to more action?
I think it's a lot to do with economic and political structures, really. I think four-year terms for MPs and governments mean there's, the motivation for them to think long-term is pretty tiny. I think, for businesses, making the changes that are necessary involve, again, really long-term thinking. There are very few businesses that kind of have those resources. I remember going to a talk by the head of Shell a few years ago. So this is a giant, you know, mega corporation. And those businesses do have the resources to do that kind of planning. And, you know, and they understood then, I mean, this was 2010, that the scenarios were bleak. But, you know, they still didn't take action because all the incentives in our society are for short-term action, shareholder reward, making the voters happy today.
What do you think of XR's plans for a citizens' assembly then? Do you think that's a solution to those problems?
I think everything helps. And I think those things are difficult. So I wrote a book about protest, actually, in 2006 and 2007, which was a lot around environmental protest. It was about the tools that are available. And the difficulty is always, you need to have the power, you need to have the bodies to do it, the passion. And I think that although Extinction Rebellion have managed to bring so much enthusiasm and energy to what they've done, the reality of the political climate at the moment and the big, big, big problem is that there are so many other problems that are pulling our attention away from this. Trump. I don't want to say any more B words, but any B words at all. But there are just some other issues. And I really worry that that's going to stop us taking the action we need. And it doesn't really matter. It doesn't really matter what else we do. But that's in my bleak moments. In my happy moments, I think we've got fantastic people like Extinction Rebellion. We'll be fine.
In your happy moments, then, what are the kind of changes that you'd really like to see in the future?
Well, I mean, it is so potentially exciting. I mean, the RSA brought out its Farming Commission report this week, which has been, I was reading it on the way down here. And if you think about the potential future, if we take some of the, you know, positive actions that would lead us towards a more sustainable future, actually, they're uniform improvements across everything. You know, you open up the countryside more, you reward farmers for improving biodiversity, improving their soil quality, for for having more better welfare for their animals. You increase the number of jobs for young people, you improve the access for young people to sort of becoming farmers themselves. You concentrate on planting trees, on planting flowers. I mean, it's a really beautiful vision. And I just desperately want to get there and to do those things. I think, you know, we could build something amazing. It's just, we just need to be doing that instead of arguing about the EU.
Yes. I think everyone feels pretty sick of Brexit and would rather focus on the...
It feels like such a side issue. It feels so irrelevant to what we really need to be discussing, and it's incredibly frustrating, and everyone is just burnt out as hell about it.
But Brexit probably will have a big effect on farmers because of the, you know, common agricultural policy and things like that.
Yeah, but it doesn't seem, you know, I mean, it feels like we could have just got on with things for ourselves and not had... I mean, to be fair... Yeah, I mean, Gove has been great. Michael Gove is the environment secretary, and he's been the one. I think most environmentalists are still in slight shock about the fact that we would never think we'd find ourselves going, God, we hope Gove doesn't get moved on. It's bewildering that we can be thinking this, but he's been pretty incredible. He's grasped the issues, and he has set out something potentially really exciting, which is more than can be said of any of the previous four environment secretaries, who were all pretty vacant. So I think that, yes, yeah, so that's been one of the few bright lights, that a Brexiteer would come up with something positive and interesting and I hope we do actually enact.
What kind of, can you give a bit more detail about the kind of plans he's laid out and why you think they're good?
Well, he wants farmers to be paid for delivering public goods. So he will move away from the current system under the CAP, the Common Agricultural Policy, where farmers are rewarded according to the sort of acreage of land that they maintain under one system of payments. And there are two systems of payments, but it's quite complicated. And they'll be paid instead for, you know, for improving the quality of their soil, for example. I went to a speech he gave about maybe a month or two after he'd become Environment Secretary, and no one was still quite sure what kind of secretary he was going to be. And he immediately just plunged into, you know, the failing, the crisis facing our soils, which is something that, you know, I'd been talking about for years, and many people have been talking about it for years, but I'd never heard a politician mention it. And it was just everyone's jaw dropped to the floor, and it was the idea that somebody had come along who could understand that we need to be focusing on the assets of our country and the assets of our planet.
You mentioned the soils. Are there any other kind of issues that you're most concerned by?
Well, falling biodiversity is too horrifying almost to think about. I mean, you know, that's one of the things that I can't even talk about it. I mean, the idea, you know, I think the things that worry me are tipping points. The things that worry me the most are the tipping points for all of this and when we hit them. Because when the IPCC, the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, began setting out its reports a few years ago, it would always measure out pathways forward with a worst case scenario and a best case scenario. And all so far, all our pathways are going along the edge of the worst case scenario. It's all happening much faster than we thought it would. And the thing that terrifies me is, when do we hit a point where we suddenly do irreparable damage? And I worry that's much, I think a lot of scientists that my colleagues speak to worry that that is either much sooner than we think or may even have happened. That's my worst case scenario, because, you know, all of these things, I mean, the planet is very resilient. Humans are very resilient. I think if we move and if we act, we can fix things fast. I mean, you know, near where my mother-in-law lives, near Abingdon, the bird, you know, they brought in red kites a few years ago, these beautiful, huge raptors. And now they are everywhere. I mean, they're like seagulls up there, and it's fantastic. They bounce back. They've taken over. I mean, these things can bounce back, but have we gone past the point where they can do that? And when do we reach that point? We really need to know.
Feels like that's not really a point. It feels like we'll only know when we've gone past that point.
I know, that's what I'm worried about.
You said that one thing that kind of drove your interest in environmental stuff was feeling really disconnected from things like food and where our food comes from. And I think that's probably true of a lot of people. I grew up in this area in the countryside, and I have no idea where, like, most of the food I eat comes from. What's one way do you think we can help people become more connected and more interested in the provenance of their food?
It was really funny, actually. There was so I live in Brighton, and there was someone posted, there's a local community sort of website, which is amazing, the Hanover community pages. And someone posted angrily that basically their local nursery had been incubating chicks. So they basically bring the chicks in and they hatch them in the nursery, and then the children help bring them up. And then and she was saying she thought this was outrageous and, you know, like a disgraceful abuse of the animals' rights. And a lot of people came back at her really fast. Just said, look, how are they going to learn? You know, we've got to get used to it. I mean, I did a story about a school where they raised pigs and then they turned them into sausages and then they ate the sausages. And I think that's really good. You know, you need to, I think the more children can understand, I mean, it is to do about education, getting children out into the countryside, getting them outside as much as possible. Children love being outside. You know, I mean, my boys, I've got three boys, and we'd drag them off to the woods every chance we got, and they would always moan. And then we'd get there and they just like would vanish off into the distance, and you just hear these kind of yelps over the top of the hill, and, you know, it was like their natural environment. You just, but people don't have enough access to it. That's why opening up the countryside, you know, I mean, in Scotland, for example, you have the right to roam wherever you want, but in England, you've got, you know, this very narrow strip of pathways that you can get to, which just infuriates me so much. you know, we need to open up the countryside and make sure, you know, we need to improve rural transport networks and just make sure everyone has access to it and it's not just a bunch of rich people.
When you were kind of starting to report on agricultural issues, were there any things that you were really surprised to learn about that you had just never, ever even thought about that, let alone thought that was how it happened?
Oh, I mean, so many things. I mean, the more I've looked at it, the more horrifying I find it. I mean, industrial agriculture really is a revolting organism. And I think that a lot of the farmers involved are good people, you know, who really try to make it work as much as possible. But things like gestation crates for pigs, I didn't know about them. I don't know how I didn't know about them, but I just kind of, I think I closed my eyes. But, you know, for anyone who's not familiar with what that is, it's a crate, a cage, really. They're called crates, but there is a cage that the pregnant sow is kept in while she is pregnant to prevent her doing any damage to herself. And in the UK, we have restrictions on those, but in other countries they're widely used. And then once the sow gives birth, she's moved into another cage where she can't move. She can sort of move a few inches forward or a few inches backwards. She can't turn round. She can lie down or she can stand up, but she's, you know, incredibly restricted in her movements just so the piglets can get underneath her to feed. So basically the idea of these cages is to stop sows lying down on their piglets, squashing them, because that was happening. And, you know, on a purely logical basis, yeah, sure, you know, that makes sense. But on a realistic, considering the well-being of the pig basis, you know, these are intelligent animals. They're as intelligent as dogs. Would you treat your dog like that? Would you put your dog in a cage like that? I mean, I was really shocked. And I think that the whole system, I think reform is needed.
Did learning about those things cause you to then make actual changes in your life of the decisions that you made?
Yes, it did, although I was always pretty careful. I mean, in a way, I'm always really reluctant to talk about my own personal lifestyle choices, partly because I saw the environment movement really get sucked down that hole, and it just turned into a massive bicker about who was flying, who was doing this, who was doing that. And it became very personal. And I think it's a real mistake for these things to become personal. I think we have to avoid that. You know, we all make some good decisions and some bad decisions. And on a good day, I lead a perfect, virtuous life. And on a bad day, it's terrible. And I sort of stopped giving my, you know, I think you try to do the best you can. But the most important thing is actual systemic change. And that's what we should be looking at, not individual responsibility.
The more righteous you become about your own choices, the more open you are to criticisms and being, you know, hypocritical and things like that, I think.
I think smugness is a really terrible thing and it robs you of the, you know, people won't listen to you. You know, we all need to be really humble about what we're doing, and, you know, just nagging people is awful. I hate it. I won't listen to anyone nagging me, so why would they listen to me nagging them?
Not a very good strategy either to get people to change their behaviours by getting at them.
It doesn't work at all. I mean, the environment movement really suffered from that a few years ago, and it really, really upset me, and it burnt a lot of people out as well, I think. People just felt, you know, frustrated and upset. So I think avoid that route on all costs.
Are there any stories that you'd love to report on but you haven't been able to?
Oh, God, so many. I mean, there are so many. You know, that's always the nightmare of being a journalist. I mean, I've got a folder full of things I'd love to do. I couldn't even list them. I mean, one of the interesting things coming here actually was that when I first, you know, I sort of said I'd talk about agriculture and climate change. And when I first got this job, I started to investigate what had happened with, you know, how what had happened in the level of the international community with climate change and food. And I've sort of, and then I just got sidetracked into editing, you know, thousands of pieces and, you know, lawyers. I mean, most of what we do is investigative, so I spend most of my time talking to the lawyers. And I dug it all out. I've got stacks of documents. It's been fantastic. I've just gone through them all for this talk. You know, and now I'm thinking, I must actually get down and write that piece.
Are there any that particularly stand out to you?
I have seen a lot of what I want to do.
Yeah, all that you have done.
I don't know. They're just, I mean, we did, okay, I went back to a piece that we did on agroforestry. Well, I wrote actually just before the series started on agroforestry about 2 years ago. I really loved that. That was, I mean, that's my favourite kind of story. It's full of brilliant farmers and people who just really care, really smart people trying something, even though people around them don't do. I mean, that's one of the things I really love about this subject. You know, I have a lot of respect for people because we all feel comfortable doing what other people do. And as a journalist, you see a lot of that. And as a journalist covering this subject, you see a lot of that. I mean, I've always, you know, you try to get people to do it by suggesting everyone else is doing it. Recycling, you're the last person not doing it. You know, so you try and make it look like a great place to be rather than something you should be doing. But actually, the pioneers in these subjects are the people doing something nobody else is doing, like agroforestry or the ethical dairy, you know, and just doing real, you know, and it takes so much bravery and guts to do something like that. I love stories like that.
Can you say a bit more about agroforestry?
Agroforestry is just lovely. It's basically agroforestry and silver pasture, sort of two branches of the same science, which is how do you grow trees on farms? You know, how do you combine trees and farms? And this has taken all sorts of different shapes all over the world, depending on what climate you're in. And in Africa, in sub-Saharan Africa in particular, there are like Niger and I'm trying to think of the other countries. There are a couple of countries in that region where they've really gone mad with this and just, you know, they're growing areas covered with trees because, of course, you know, the moment you think about it, plant trees, create shade, create moisture and, you know, and change your own climate, literally. In China as well, it's really catching on. And in this country, it's different because, you know, heat isn't so much our problem. But so why use it? Some people are like, well, you're robbing your crops of some shit, you know, some sun. But the farmers say it's three-dimensional farming. You know, you're kind of diversifying. You've got apples on your trees and then you've got crops, oats or whatever, growing between them. You know, I went to one farm where they had chickens roaming around under the trees and, you know, it's smart, clever farming. It just really impresses me. And, you know, more trees, which is always a good thing.
Sounds very romantic as well.
I know. I love trees. It's just anything. They're kind of magical. As soon as you introduce them, they're so sort of, you know, I mean, it does feel like they might be the things that solve climate change after we've created such a mess.
So it's not just like repopulating forests, it's kind of creating new woodland as well.
Yeah, I mean, we need to be planting trees everywhere. I mean, I'd like to see a regulation that there's just, you can't do any building or reconstruction in cities without planting trees. You know, recently near where I live, they've sort of rebuilt all the pavements and they've got these huge expanses of empty pavement. I'm like, you know, put some trees in there, fantastic for drainage. You know, we're going to have a lot of floods with climate change. Stick a few trees in.
And then in Sheffield, you've got all these trees being cut down.
Please
by
don't
the
mention
council.
That. That is the most. Oh, yeah, that story just infuriated me so much. Mad.
You said you began your career in journalism doing kind of fashion stuff and luxury toilet rolls, which all sounds very glamorous, and it feels like farming is really not glamorous, although that's maybe unfair. Do you kind of ever miss the glamour, or no, not really?
No, it was definitely, it didn't suit me at all. This is so much more interesting, you know. I mean, farming and environmental issues, there's something powerful and interesting going on. There's an international story that needs to be covered. And the furniture, the design stuff was totally accidental. And really, I just wasn't cut out for that stuff at all. I mean, the freebies are not very good in this end of things, but I much prefer them.
Free carrots rather than free soaps.
Yeah, free nice cup of coffee, free, you know, they're not very great. But it's so, you know, you just meet the world's most interesting people and you're covering the most important story in the world. Like, you can't really ask for more.
I don't think many other newspapers kind of dedicate that much time to agricultural issues. It's more like trade kind of magazines focus on farming.
But The Guardian has always led on environmental coverage. I mean, John Vidal I think he became environment editor in the sort of 80s, I think he was already environment editor, maybe 1990. And we've always given far more space to it than anyone else. And we've really, I think we've led the world on that issue. And I think that is something that we are very, very proud of.
So the name of this podcast is Stories That Matter. So is there kind of a story, and it can be fact or fiction or just something that's happened to you in your life that you think is, you kind of look back on and be like, oh, that's really influenced what I'm doing now?
The story that had the most influence on me, probably, but for bad as much as for good, was covering Copenhagen in 2009. I went out to the climate talks with the Guardian team, and I was kind of the outside person covering the protests and the demonstrations. And I'd been, you know, I'd written this book about protests, and I'd been covering environment for the Guardian by that point for a few years. And so I knew how important it was, and we were all aware of how important it was. And it was just a really heartbreaking couple of weeks. I just remember how dark it was in Copenhagen. You'd sort of wake up and it would be dark till about 10, and then there'd be a few hours of light, and then it would get dark again. And it was cold, really, really cold, because it was December. And it was just so demoralizing to watch the most powerful people in the world get together and totally fail to do anything at all. And that was definitely, I mean, that's not a happy story, but it was a turning point for the world. And I mean, it was amazing that 6 years later, people came together in Paris and did sign a deal. But it was definitely left a mark on every journalist I know who was there.
Were you in Paris for the agreement?
No,
then?
I wasn't. No, I was covering other issues then.
Do you look on that as something that is going to be more impactful?
Yes, definitely. I mean, it's fantastic. I mean, the fact, A, the world signed a deal, brilliant. B, they were so happy about it. They were celebrating about it. You know, political leaders saw this as a step forward. I mean, the level of acceptance among politicians of climate change is much higher than it was in 2009 or before. I mean, politicians like Macron now see this as somewhere they can make their name, something important, you know, that they need to be seen as sort of leaders on. Yeah, I mean, the climate has changed politically, radically, but whether it's changed enough is another matter.
And whether the Paris Agreement will be upheld. I don't want to mention the T word, but...
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, that's my worry, you know. I mean, I just worry that other things are going to push this aside. I mean, the SDGs, the Sustainable Development Goals that were signed at the United Nations in, I think, is it 2016, 2015? A lot of people aren't familiar with that, but it's a set of goals for the world. Most countries have signed up to them. I think there were 17 of them. They're incredibly ambitious. They're about, you know, reducing hunger, but they're also about sustainable development, about, you know, for agriculture, for energy, paths forward for nations. Those actually lay out a pretty good sort of global green deal. You know, if you read through them, it's a very ambitious plan, which would change things radically, but no one's talking about them, because all we talk about is Trump's latest tweet, you know, what's going on in Iran. I mean, fair enough, we should be talking about that. It's maddening. It's maddening.
Thanks for listening to Stories That Matter, a Hawkwood podcast. Find out more about Hawkwood and Seed Festival by following the links in the show notes. This episode was produced by Laura Bing, with music by Daisy and her Cora, playing an original composition, Berta.